This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. HPR's Ku'uwe Hirishi joins us this morning. All eyes will be now on where the investigations into multiple ethics complaints linked to the Ke Alohas go from here. Ku'uwe, they were, apparently on pause while these criminal cases were going forward?
That's right. So they've got two. The Honolulu Ethics Commission has currently two open investigations into what's being characterized as misuse of city resources by the Ke Aloha, so both ex-police chief Louis Ke Aloha and deputy prosecutor, former deputy prosecutor Catherine Ke Aloha, his wife. Apparently they had installed cameras on their property for surveillance, and that was city property, and also used several members of the police force, a particular investigative unit, to sort of surveil in the case with her uncle, right, Gerard Puana, who they tried to frame for the theft of their mailbox. So that investigation is still open. Those two cases are still open, but they are awaiting the results of the federal criminal investigations and trials. So it's been on hold for about 5 years now, maybe 4 years actually. But at the recent Ethics Commission meeting, the Ethics Commission was basically defending its handling of these complaints. So for folks who may not have caught up on this, the commission launched a series of investigations back in 2014 that stalled a year later after its main investigator and the former, or main prosecutor and former director of the Honolulu Ethics Commission, Chuck Tado, was pulled from the case. And this happened, according to the commission, because of ethics complaints filed by the Ke Alohas against Tado for things like conflict of interest, things that Tado himself has said are unfounded allegations. But it was enough to get the commission to pull Tado off that case. And also in that process, the Caldwell administration did not renew the contract for the lead investigator in that case, Letha DeCares, who had kind of gone through a lot of the legwork on the case. So,
and we should point out that she was a former employee of the police department.
She was HPD captain, mm-hmm. Exactly. So her insight into the inner workings of HPD, but also her connection and relationships with some of those at the higher levels of HPD, was something that the investigation had some value in, pursuing. But Victoria Marks, so now the chair of the Honolulu Ethics Commission, basically wanted to set things straight in this recent meeting on Wednesday, and this is what she had to say.
We're moving along. We're just doing our job the best we feel we can. I think there's been misinformation out there, as I said, and that, we hired a prosecutor to take over the Ke Aloha cases. We hired an investigator to take over those things. And we were dealing with three lawsuits brought by the Ke Alohas at the same time. There is an awful lot going on.
That's right. So on top of complaints against Tado and DeCares by the Ke Alohas, there were civil lawsuits that were filed for same thing, sort of this unfair, unfounded investigation or witch hunt into the Ke Alohas was what those civil cases were characterized as. But Chuck Tado, the former director of the commission, was at the meeting himself and did testify, saying he wasn't convinced at all by the timeline or by the commission's sort of defending themselves. He sees things as, so after he went ahead and he was pulled from the case, and DeCares was also pulled from the case, the lead investigator, or her contract wasn't renewed, he went ahead and resigned. And there was a lot of controversy surrounding that from onlookers on the outside, thinking that the commission had actually forced him out, and or the Caldwell administration had forced him out under pressure. But he, Tado, had said at the meeting that, it wasn't any direct order to resign. He just felt he really wasn't able to do his job. And so here's Tado after the commission meeting.
We wanted to be squeaky clean. We didn't.
The Ke Alohas did not say fire Chuck Tado or tell me to resign or anything like that. The problem was I was unable to do my job once those cases were taken away from me. You can't take a case that's been worked up for a year and the hundreds of hours of Letha. I think at that point Letha had probably interviewed 50 witnesses. You can imagine trying to interview 50 police officers, especially at the highest level.
That's right. So right now they do have Lincoln Ishida, a former corporation counsel from the Big Island, from Hilo, who's got a lot of experience in this particular type of investigation. And he's currently overseeing the will and oversee the prosecution of these two particular cases. Now, Tato had said when he left, when he resigned from the commission, they had around 17 estimated cases open. So complaints against either Kealoha for in various sort of degrees of seriousness, including possible corruption. So Tato was sort of, you know, kind of perplexed as to what happened to the other cases. According to the commission, they aren't made aware of every single case that comes through the commission staff. They do end up at the commission meetings, but they don't particularly are not always addressed. So that's the line that they're taking, at least. But this is what Marks had to say for why Tato was pulled off the case.
We wanted to be squeaky clean. We didn't want anything that we did to be tainted in any way. Hindsight's always 20/20, but in the moment, there was an apparent conflict of interest.
So right now, I think everything's on hold in terms of the ethics complaints against the Kealohas. We do know that Catherine Kealoha, both have been found guilty in the federal charges for obstruction of justice and also for corruption, but that Catherine is in jail and the former police chief has been free on bail. So these issues will not go away. It will be interesting once the criminal cases are taken care of to see whether or not the Ethics Commission will pursue these ethics complaints, because essentially, I mean, they've got no money. They've really got nothing. The Kealohas have nothing. So it will be, I guess, a sense of vindication for people like Tato to figure out, you know, how this goes.
I think the overarching, though, concern that some folks might have is the cost of the taxpayers, because the commission is looking at hiring outside counsel, and it's just like, where does it end?
That's a great point, and that point was raised at the recent meeting, especially with having to figure out. So the complaints that were lodged against Tato and DeCares as well is also under investigation by an outside prosecutor in terms of whether or not they had any sort of vindictive pursuing of the Kealohas in the ethics complaint. So both investigations still ongoing, and we'll see where it goes.
Right. Lots of pressure on the Ethics Commission now, though, and we'll have to be tracking those meetings.
Exactly.
And the next one is next month, I think.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Kubehi.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been chatting with HPR's Kubehi Hiraishi about the ethics issue linked to the public corruption case of Louis Kealoha and his wife, Catherine.
One. 50 years ago, a new era of space exploration began.
Liftoff on Apollo 11.
I'm Ira Flatow. On Science Friday, we'll follow workers upgrading an historic Apollo launch pad for the next moon mission.
She's 52 years old. She got a really extensive makeover, and she looks fantastic.
It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your Aloha Friday Backyard Quiz. For today's Backyard Quiz, we delve into the newsprint archives and spotlight the first time feminist rhetoric appeared in print in Hawaii. a little four-page newspaper that came out in Hawaii back in the dark days before women were allowed to vote, posed a direct challenge to prevailing ideas at the time. The Folio, as it was called, celebrated the accomplishments of intrepid women, from everyday wives and mothers to a woman who took over command of a sailing vessel when her husband, the captain, fell ill. The paper even invoked a local deity, suggesting that Madame Pele would be far from pleased with men who didn't treat women as equals. It put forth some pretty radical ideas for the time, and our backyard quiz question for today is, what was the year that this paper was published? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programs. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Health, Ulupono Initiative, and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working.
The United States economy hit a major milestone recently. At 121 months in length, we are officially into the longest period of economic expansion since record-keeping began in the 1850s. Now, although the next recession may not be as severe as the Great Recession of 2008, one will eventually happen. The Hawaii Budget and Policy Center just released a report detailing how Hawaii was impacted by that recession and how we can prepare for the next one. Beth Giesting is the group's director, and she discussed the findings with HPR's Ryan Finnerty.
We certainly are not predicting another recession anytime immediately, and we are certainly hoping that it isn't of the magnitude of the Great Recession. But there are some signs that things are weakening. Here in Hawaii, we are seeing the unemployment rate is creeping up. There are more bankruptcies that have been filed. Hotel occupancy is down, and that's always a telling sign for us. Home sales have softened. And then on the national level, there is a lot of volatility in the stock market, and there is that yield curve inversion where short-term interest rates are higher than long-term interest rates. So all of those indicate that we should be cautious.
And you made a good point earlier that that not every recession is as big or as severe as the Great Recession. But what were some of the impacts to Hawaii from that event? And what should we be concerned about going forward as inevitably another recession will come?
Well, I think the reason we were so interested in this issue is that we know that recessions hurt lower income workers the most, people who are not making real big wages or who are working hourly. And so we're very concerned about them. And of course, also victims, if you will, of recessions are state government because their resources are reduced by recessions. And there are also a lot more demands placed on them because people's needs go up. So we were really concerned about what happened during the last time and feel strongly that now is the time for our policymakers and other state leaders to be thinking about reviewing what happened during the Great Recession and coming up with some priorities and plans to try to make sure that we have as good outcomes as we can possibly get the next time we have to tighten our belts. So some of the things that did happen during the Great Recession, I think for starters, the visitor industry saw very major impacts. There were about 1 million fewer visitors from one year to the next. And the fewer visitors also reduced their lengths of stay. So there were 9 million fewer visitor days as the recession progressed. And that took $3 billion, with a B, $3 billion out of our economy. So that was really tough. Of course, the visitor industry supports a lot of jobs. And the unemployment rate increased from about just under 3% to an average of 7% during the recession. But I also note that unemployment rates were much higher on neighbor islands than they were on Oahu, and particularly on the Big Island, which averaged 10% unemployment for a very long time during the last recession. There were about 44,000 jobs lost during the recession, and about half of them were related to visitor industry, retail, services, the kinds of jobs that really depend on people coming and spending tourist dollars. But there was also a big impact on construction, and about 1 in 4 construction jobs disappeared during the recession, too.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, very.
You mentioned, Beth, that the state government ended up bearing a lot of the brunt of the recession. What are some of the lessons that our elected officials or appointed officials could learn from this report in preparing for the next recession?
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is that when the economy goes in decline, tax receipts are going to be much reduced. First, income tax is going to be reduced, and then with less economic activity, there's going to be a big decrease in general excise tax receipts, and those are the big sources of income here. So when you have less money, and during the recession, the first year of the recession, tax receipts decreased by $500 million, and they stayed in the doldrums between 2009 until 2012. So there was a good 4 or 5 years that tax receipts were really low. And when the tax receipts are low, then government needs to cut its costs, and that's really tough. Some of the things that we did, you'll recall Furlough Fridays, I think, and that had its good sides as well as its bad, by keeping on state workers, even if it's with reduced hours, that improved the situation by not increasing unemployment and had more people who are working and contributing and so forth. But when we didn't discriminate among the services that we were providing and we just passed out the furloughs evenly across all state agencies, I think that that was not a particularly well thought out strategy, because the furlough Fridays resulted in our school kids losing about a month of instructional time, which is a really serious effect on their futures, as well as their parents, who had to try to figure out what they were going to do when their kids were out of school for such an extended period of time. And I think that, you know, maybe if the effects had been reserved for, say, the Department of Transportation, most people would not have noticed as much.
The report mentions that one of the consequences of making sure there were no layoffs of the state workforce was that state funding to nonprofits was cut pretty drastically, and that those organizations ended up having to lay people off and reduce services. What was the impact of that?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was a really important issue as well. The state contracts with a number of nonprofit agencies to provide the state's services. And these are very efficient and effective and based in the community. And I think that there was a tendency for the state to see them as kind of the first programs that could be cut when the state budget had to go. But the problem is that that meant that many services that are provided in the community for all kinds of health, human services, mental health, family supports, all kinds of things were lost, and that has had a very lasting impact to services in the community, to the nonprofit organizations themselves, and I think to the detriment of the state. One of the things that was particularly disturbing was when we saw how many cuts there were to our mental health services.
And I imagine there's a pretty significant lag between even when the recession ends and we start hiring new people and bringing those services back and funding for those, that's not just something that can be brought back up to speed overnight.
Yeah, very definitely. And for those nonprofits that lost services, some of them were statewide and had to cut offices across the state. They had to reduce their capacity in all kinds of ways. And that, of course, you lose a lot of experienced people who are best able to provide the services. And so it does take a long time to rebuild from that. But the lag time, I think, is an important issue, too, for state government. And that is that once we don't know that we're in a recession until after it's already started. So by the time you actually see the effects, the recession is well underway, and the recovery is also on a lag time. So you don't actually start bringing in the tax receipts and be able to increase your state services again until a couple of years later. So the recession officially started in December 2007. It didn't really show up as a big effect in state budgets until 2009. And then the recession supposedly was over in 2009, but the state budget didn't really recover until 2012.
So it's something that you really have to be proactive about and prepare for, much like preparing for a hurricane or something like that before it pops up on the radar.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that the severity of the last recession really should give all policymakers pause and help frame the kinds of discussions they should be having now. And we think that the most important thing to do is to come up with a plan and a priority list for essential services. Let's make sure that whatever we cut, we try to preserve the things that are most important to state residents and to the future and well-being of our state going forward.
We'll have to leave it at that. Beth Giesting of the Hawaii Budget and Policy Center, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ryan.
And you can read the Recession in Review report at hawaiipublicradio.org. Honolulu Civil Beat regularly gives us our reality check, and today we follow up on a series about over-tourism. Kirsten Downey on the line with us this morning. Hi there.
Hello.
So you folks hosted a meeting in the community this week.
That's right. Civil Beat has been hosting a series of what we call our Civil Beat Cafes, Civil Cafes, where we gather people together to talk about issues of all kinds of things that are of common concern in Hawaii, things that our readers have written and told us about, and things that we've covered. And we've been writing a comprehensive series on all the ways that Hawaii is being pressured by the surge of tourism. And our reporter, Stuart Yurton, did a close-up look at Kailua and found that Kailua is one of the places that's been under the most strain. So we decided to do a civil cafe there on Wednesday night, and it drew hundreds of people.
Yes, it is amazing that we've hit a nerve on this, because I remember at another session that we did with Zocalo on overtourism, the numbers were huge of the people who were really interested.
Well, I feel like there's a part of the way is the structure of the government is in Hawaii, and with the strong county government, it makes it hard for local communities to have venues to talk about issues that just affect them. And I think people in Kailua were delighted to have a chance to gather and talk about an issue that wasn't Oahu-wide, but strictly focused on Kailua.
Right, because they have they've been feeling the pressure from the beaches in Lanikai, that parking issue, to the pillbox being worn down. I mean, so many stresses for that community.
Well, yes, and really the Laura Thielen sort of set the stage for the whole event early on when she talked about how tourism has increased in her lifetime. She moved to Hawaii or moved to Kailua in the 60s. And back then, the population of tourists was about 500,000 a year. It grew to 8 million by 2005 to 10 million this year. And she's projecting that they're going to have 12 million by 2020. And she noted that with all that time, with all that surge of tourism, the street infrastructure has never changed. We've never been able to update it to accommodate that huge swell and growth of visitors.
Right. And, you know, they're feeling, I think, what the North Shore has been feeling for decades, where everybody wants to go up to see the big waves on the North Shore, and there's just that little highway. But, yeah, it's tough.
They feel overwhelmed. They feel like it's out of control. And they also feel very nostalgic for the past. I think that was one of the things that was sort of touching about the events, is people wanting to reminisce about a time that you could walk into Long's Drugs and know a lot of the people that were there, the other customers and the staff as well, whereas now when you go to Long's, it's going to be full of tourists.
Right, and it's just certainly changed from being that sleepy town to an area that's just inundated with vacation rentals, and that's also helped to bring things in. So really, it's a complicated issue.
Well, the vacation rentals thing, at least with the group that gathered for our event on Wednesday night, the vacation rentals debate is, it's very clear in their minds that they're bad, that they've been bad. 85% of the attendees, we did a cell phone poll that allowed people to give their opinions on different things that have happened in Kailua, and 85% of them thought that the explosion of vacation rentals had been bad for Kailua. They also, 85% also said that they believed that Kailua was being managed by government officials primarily for the benefit of tourists and not for the benefit of local residents. And in fact, went so far as to say they thought it was just simply mismanaged.
And that's really the key, is how do we manage the numbers better?
That's right. And some of the things that people were putting on the table were ideas like creating smartphone apps that could track where tourists go, charge them for use of certain facilities. Someone proposed gating off Lanikai and sort of turning Lanikai into sort of a national park where you have to pay admission to get in, or where you're able to exclude people from entry. So there was some enthusiasm for that, just for the fact that it would control the population, the surge of the tourists coming. But others pushed back and said, you know, one of the beauties of Hawaii has been that we've always had open access to our beaches and to our trails. And if we start to charge everybody for them, it's going to be a loss of identity, a loss of a sense of communal enjoyment of the beauty and amenities of Hawaii.
And I think, you know, with what made Kailua and Lanikai so special, right? I mean, we had President Barack Obama stay in that area, and that drew even more attention and more curiosity about this town. But it was great that you folks were able to get the Harold Castle Foundation to provide a voice in that forum.
That was really interesting, because of course the Castle Foundation had been the original landowner in Kailua, or let's say the landowner of the last 100 years, and sold land off to Alexander and Baldwin, which has been redeveloping and upgrading downtown Kailua. And of course that's also been very controversial. So we were very glad that Castle participated and made the case for Alexander and Baldwin, but Alexander and Baldwin representatives chose not to attend. They said they had no one available to come and speak.
Yeah, but still, very important issue, and very good to get the community feedback. Thanks so much, Kirsten.
Thank you.
That was Kirsten Downey with today's Reality Check. To read the stories related to the over-tourism issue, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Manoa Valley Theater, The musical comedy, The Rocky Horror Show, tells of a young couple who run into misadventure, including meeting an alien transvestite scientist, now through August 4th. ManoaValleyTheater.com.
On our long view today, Neil Milner talks sexism in the presidential election. Good morning.
Good morning.
So is there a difference between, let's say, sexism in the primary and the general?
Yes, there is a difference that we suspected anyway, because in a primary, you don't have the cues that generally help you decide in a big way how you're going to vote in a general election. That is, in a general election, the most important cue is what party the candidate is. And overwhelmingly, the overwhelming majority of us vote that way the same time. Is it a Republican? That's the dominant cue. And by the time the election rolls around, that's dominating. So there, sexism goes into the background. So if you think about 2020, this study that I'm talking about says, well, there's a good chance that the sexism that exists in primaries is not going to affect Democratic voters in 2020, that they'll still vote for a woman candidate because they're so anxious to get rid of Trump and because party identification is so important. But this is what's interesting. They did two surveys to look at the role that sexism plays for the Democratic candidates right now in the primaries, where, again, you don't have that, you know, everybody's a Democrat. No party elites are endorsing, so it's a crapshoot out there. And what you do find is that controlling for everything else, people who are sexist, that is, Democratic voters who are sexist, are less likely to vote for women. And it's a fairly strong kind of thing. Now, Democratic voters are less sexist, and this is measured. There's a kind of battery of tests that you use that are fairly well established. Democratic voters are less sexist than general. Nevertheless, about a quarter of these voters in the survey have these kind of sexist attitudes. And so what happens, if you got those attitudes, you're less likely to support a woman candidate right now. If you take someone like Biden and Warren, for people who are not very sexist, Biden and Warren get about the same amount of votes. Biden's approval stay about the same. But for if you look at more sexist people, Warren's acceptance rate, that is, would you vote for him, drops way down. Now, again, as I say, it's tentative. They're not saying they wouldn't vote for them. They're saying it's not their choice. So that's the interesting thing about it. You have to keep in mind how primaries are different and how the sexism may not play out. But you also have to keep in mind how this suggests what we know from other research, that women who run for office face certain kind of stereotypes and certain kind of obstacles that they have to overcome.
Well, I just remember watching the debates. I mean, there's so dang many of them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, running. And visually, it was just, oh, my gosh, you know, just coming from TV and knowing how difficult those debates are to engineer, it's like, holy crow, there's so many running.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's part of the problem. But you can see two things, right? You can see gender and you can see race. And so this one looked at, so if you don't know anything else, people can tell, is that a woman, is it not a woman? And that kicks off certain kind of things. But you're right. The primaries, this primary right now in particular, is just chaotic. It's just totally open. Unlike the 2016 election, it was pretty clear that Hillary Clinton was getting most of the party elite support. Bernie then came on, but you didn't have this multiple sort of situation, so that the folks were picking up cues pretty early. This is still a long way from the election. Things are just starting. It will probably start to sort itself out, at least as some candidates don't get any money. There'll be a top tier and a second tier, but it's going to be a long time for it to happen. But I think you have to keep in mind that although most people say, overwhelming majority of people say they would vote for a woman, that's not an issue anymore. But what they expect from women candidates is different from what they expect from men candidates. They're more tolerant of incompetence from men than they are from women. Women have this walking this tightrope between having to show a kind of assertiveness but being likable at the same time. Now, if you look at the record, women are doing pretty well overcoming these obstacles, but you have to keep in mind that those are the dynamics that they have to face. And when you listen to women in the primary debates, for example, see if you can pick up some of these kinds of things, this likability thing.
The nuances.
The nuances. I mean, no one ever asks men if they're likable. But women, women who win office are more likely to be more competent and experienced than men. But people will vote for an inexperienced man before they'll cut an inexperienced man candidate more slack than they'll cut an inexperienced woman candidate.
Well, we saw in the debates how Tulsi Gabbard, you know, was the most Googled candidate after that first forum.
I guess that's right, which is kind of interesting and may suggest where her appeal is, because she hasn't moved the arrow in her favor at anything at all. She essentially, at best, is a second-tier candidate in terms of the kind of qualification. Now, she's in the next debate because she's been able to raise the money and been in other kinds of things, but she's not really had the jump that other candidates. She didn't drop. She had a fairly small percentage. She didn't drop as a result of the primary. She didn't gain from the primary debate. She didn't gain from the primary debate. The way, let's say, if you want to just look at women candidates, the way Elizabeth Warren has established herself and the way Kamala Harris has established themselves. So, again, you have to be careful about lumping all women together because in some ways, they face some of the same things, but they bring different kinds of stuff to the table.
Right, and we saw with Tulsi, she was one of the youngest to be elected here at the legislature, you know, the first Hindu candidate. She's got the military service, so she stands out. But then, as you mentioned, there are some obstacles that women face just in general.
Well, that's right. And some of the obstacles any candidate faces, they have to jump over, and that is raising money and getting people to support them. That is fairly important people. And you're starting to see that get sorted out a little bit more. Although, again, party elites that used to play a bigger role in this are not making endorsements yet. So that's what Tulsi and, to some extent, Amy Klobuchar are a little bit more behind. And they have to face the fact that they need more than just being one, you know, that they sooner or later they're going to have to jump into a tier that's moving forward.
And so, then once we get through the primary and then there's a general.
If you have to say a couple of things about one thing about gender now and one thing about the present presidential race going into 2020, the one thing about gender that you have to say is that if among Democrats that it's likely that the sexism that plays out in the primary is not likely to play out anywhere near as strong in the general, because people will vote for Trump. By the way, remember that 50% or slightly bigger of white women voted for Trump. So it gets pretty messy here. The other thing is that if you look at the 2020 election right now and you put it in as simple terms as possible, the good predictors, that is the models that we use to look ahead of elections that are based on some good history, the ones that emphasize economic factors have Trump winning. The ones that emphasize what you would call political factors, like approval ratings, which is generally a fairly good indicator, they have Trump losing, roughly. So that's part of the dynamic. If that's the basic dynamic and gender plays itself out then it's you get a sense of how this thing is going.
Right, but strange things have happened. I mean, who would have thought that yes. we would have had a Republican female governor in Hawaii, right?
Well, yeah. Listen, you could have the shortest interview with me every other week by just asking, did strange things happen? I would say yes, and you'd go to the next person.
Okay, the long view. Neil Milner, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Neil Milner is a retired professor of political science and contributing editor of our segment, The Long View. Find out more on our Facebook page, The Conversation HPR.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors The Rice Partnership, Kaiser Permanente, and PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we told you about a small local publication that's been called the first feminist journal published west of the Rocky Mountains. It was a four-pager called The Folio, printed on the occasion of an event to benefit the Sailors' Home in Honolulu. The missionary and newspaper editor, Reverend Samuel C. Damon, printed and circulated The Folio as an insert into his own newspaper called The Friend. Now, the authors were anonymous, but research at the Hawaii Historical Society suggests that the authors were Julia Damon, the Reverend's wife, and Catherine Whitney, wife of Henry Whitney, editor of the Pacific Commercial Advertiser. Both women came from the East Coast, where liberal ideas about women's rights held sway. But even so, the date of publication, 1855, makes The Folio a newspaper that was well ahead of its time. No winners today for our quiz, but that was today's quiz. And if you have an idea for one, do send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Mission to Mars. That was the theme of a week-long science camp this summer aimed at giving girls a leg up in aerospace. Chris Yocum of the Pisces Program, which is a state-funded center, talked with us about the effort aimed at nurturing female scientists.
The program that we have is called the Women's Stars Program. It's specifically focused on high school women, and we're trying to encourage them to pursue careers in STEM by connecting them with mentors, educators, and women scientists and engineers who can kind of give them a real-world perspective on what it's like to work in the field they're in, and also give them encouragement, mentorship, and resources that they can pursue to go into these fields. Our organization, Pisces, we're a state-funded aerospace agency. We're involved in overseeing and coordinating the whole program. So what I do is I get in contact with people in the aerospace community, the astronomy community, engineering community, local educators, basically women who are passionate about STEM and who really want to participate in this program. And we set up presentations, we set up tours, we set up hands-on activities and group projects to engage the students with. And so basically it's set up like a space and science camp where we have a week of the students going to different places on the islands. They go to the summit of Mauna Kea to view the observatories at the summit. They go to the Hawaii Ocean Science and Technology Park. They do hands-on conservation work. They see Volcano National Park. They do robotics workshops. Basically, a lot of different varieties of activities within STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, to give them a good idea of what's out there in these fields and kind of like what it's it's going to be like to work in them.
Do we track their progress?
We do have some numbers on that, and it seems that the program is effective in both encouraging the students who attend to go into STEM and retaining their interest. We're kind of in the process of getting follow-up surveys of all the students that have gone through the program to get a better idea.
And do you know, what else are we doing to maybe reach down into the lower grades to spark that interest?
We have a robotics program for Keokaha students out here on the east side of Hawaii. And we do a lot of outreach events that are tailored toward younger children. Educationally, we go into schools, do outreach and hands-on events. This specific program has been for just for high school girls, so we've only had this specific program for them.
Well, there's lots of focus on space, given the big anniversary that we're marking in July. You know, and the desire to go back to the moon again and beyond. So it's exciting times for space and science.
That excitement definitely carries over. These girls get to see what's possible for the future of space exploration. This year, we had a woman who is a scientist who designed all the life support systems on the International Space Station. So she gave a live video presentation to the girls and told them, this is what we did starting back in the 80s. We had to start from scratch and figure out how microbiology works in space and design all these systems. And it was really interesting to learn about.
And I think, too, the need to focus not just on young women, but, you know, women of color, to get the diversity into the space program. I know there was that wonderful movie where they talked about all the women that were math whizzes that were on the ground, African-American women who really played a big part in getting our astronauts up there successfully and safely back home.
Yeah, absolutely. Hidden Figures, we showed
yes.
that actually during the program.
That's a terrific movie. That really drives home just the unsung heroes of that time. And how critical a part they play in our success as a country.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely.
If there are other students out there that are interested, you know, how do they get involved? How do they connect and get their application in for next year?
Our website has the applications, has a whole web page about the Pisces Stars program. We open the applications usually in mid-March and begin accepting applicants. And we also send out a newsletter through our website that keeps our subscribers up to date. We also have social media, Facebook and Twitter, where we keep everyone updated on the status of the program. So students can apply online. It's a short application process. They do need to have a minimum 3.0 GPA, and they need to write a one-page essay talking about why they want to join the program. And any student in the state of Hawaii, a high school girl 14 or older, is eligible to attend.
That was my next question, is that, you know, if you're from Molokai or Lanai and want some time, you know, at Mauna Kea and at OTEC there in Kona, you know, what are your chances of getting in? I mean, you pick up their airfare, or how does that all work?
For students coming from other islands, the one cost for them will be their airfare. The program, we provide the program for free in terms of on-island transportation on the Big Island. We also provide all the accommodations and meals while the students are doing the camp. But if for the students coming from other islands, right now we don't have enough funding to cover inter-island airfare. But I'm pretty optimistic about the way the program's going. We've been getting increasingly more funding from different sponsors. This year we got sponsored by Caterpillar, the heavy equipment manufacturer, and we also received a grant from the Hawaii Community Foundation's Career Connected Learning Program. So I feel like it's getting more traction, and we're really getting solid results out of the program. We're going to be able to do more with it in the years coming.
I know the industry, you know, they say, well, these are great, good paying jobs, but how many people that are in those jobs are from Hawaii? So we kind of want to grow our pool of qualified applicants for these jobs.
Sure, absolutely. And that's part of what we're doing at Pisces, is trying to create more people who are skilled in technology and engineering, but also being able to create those opportunities for them to stay here in Hawaii and work. We do that through our internship program as well that we have for college students.
I know earlier this year there was the unfortunate incident where they didn't have enough uniforms, astronaut uniforms, I think, for the women.
Yes, I saw that. I also saw an SNL skit about it.
Yeah, it's just not fair, but it's kind of the built-in bias, I think, you know, in a program that was predominantly male.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things they're talking about as part of the Artemis program now is getting a woman to the moon, to the surface of the moon, for the next big lunar mission. So hopefully that trend will shift a little bit into balance.
Yeah, we have to break through that glass ceiling, even in outer space.
Yeah, exactly. We have so many really intelligent, talented students that we see come through our programs. Through our STARS program, we have so many young women who are really interested in what we're presenting to them, and they want to be able to pursue those things in here in Hawaii, and they're looking for opportunities. A lot of our interns that we have come through here are the same. We had one that just went on to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He's working on the Mars 2020 rover. And it'd be great to have more opportunities like that here in Hawaii. So that's something that we are working on trying to fulfill.
That was Chris Yocum, Public Information Officer at Pisces, talking about a summer program designed to get girls into the STEM fields of science, technology, engineering, and math. And we should note, as we mark the historic Apollo moon landing tomorrow, lots of events around town, including a whole day of activities at Windward Community College. You can check out the moon rocks and better understand Hawaii's part in that historic event. Check our website for links.
Sunday at 3 p.m., join us on HPR2 for the next Hawaii Symphony Orchestra broadcast. HSO Concertmaster Iggy Jang brings a vivid program featuring Vu Tomp, Lily Boulanger, and Tchaikovsky. Sunday following Sunday Baroque.
Sponsored by Furniture Plus Design.
That is it for this week. Coming up next week, we continue to explore homeless solutions and keep an eye on the Mauna Kea saga. We would like to hear from you. Call or talk back line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to hear today's show again or get a past show or links to more information, go to the conversation page on the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Harrison Patino. And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday and pick up the conversation. Hawaii Talks.